Time skipping episode of SFP Now. Joining me as always to go over some news items is Reesa. The special guest interview this week is with none other than Kick-Ass creator himself, Mark Millar, who's going to be talking to us about, you know, various comic books that he's done and lots and lots of other stuff as well. But before we hit that, let's go out with some news. I think the first bit of news we've got really is a pretty important bit of news is BBC have released the Doctor Who prequel to the oncoming series, which will be hitting screens next weekend on the 19th of September, and it's kind of left us with more questions than it has answers, hasn't it, Reesa?
It has.
Right, will the BBC survive? He's one of them.
Yeah, it's ironic because back during the classic period, the BBC cancelled Doctor Who, and it looks like this time around the BBC could get cancelled before Doctor Who does. It's weird. We're in a very strange time with this whole franchise and the context of everything. But to get back to the prequel, it's rather wonderful. It's sort of a follow-up to The Night of the Doctor. And we meet the priestess of Karn, played by the same actress. Her name is Okila, according to the press. And she's talking to Capaldi's doctor, and they have a conversation.
Which
that sets up...
Yeah, sets up the episode, but it's kind of left on a very ominous song like... You know, it's left very inconclusive. It's kind of left, making you wonder what's going to happen next. It leaves you wanting more.
Yes, and that's, I think, they did their jobs because we're going to want to watch the episode. But it's basically setting up why it is the Doctor isn't with Clara initially when we meet Clara, because there's going to be a period of separation, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And... It's setting that up.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's sort of like it's, I'm just wondering how much of this series is going to tie into, because Big Finish have some things happening later on in the year with their new unit series and stuff like that, and you know, you got, you know, River Song in that, and also the Brigadier's daughter, Kate Stewart.
Yeah. Yes, and River Song will also be appearing on screen in the Christmas episode. So yeah, you got to wonder how much of this is actually going to be tied together. We can only see, you know.
Mhm. It'd be interesting to see if any of it ties together. Given that historically, Big Finish and the BBC have never really had that much of a tight relationship when it comes to. Having Big Finish use any of the new characters or the new faces of Doctor Who from the 2005 series onwards.
Yeah, this is new territory. I've mentioned this briefly before in that the downside of the Big Finish company acquiring all this stuff is that the BBC is basically tacitly acknowledging that they're out of the spin-off business.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a double-edged sword. So,
yeah, you never know. And talking about spin-offs, you've listened to the first episode of the new Torchwood spin-off that Big Finish have been doing, and I believe you got news about series two already announced.
Yes, our series two is already announced, and on top of that, Series 1, which I listened to the first episode of, and my review of that is already on the site. Anyone who wants to see that is welcome to read it. series one is 6 episodes. Series two will be 6 episodes. Both series will cover various different time periods in Torchwood history, allowing for various actors to be featured in different episodes. There'll be, you know, each 6-episode run will also be an ongoing storyline with the episodes interlinked. The first run of 6 episodes will conclude in February, and then the second run of episodes will literally start March, so there'll be no break, which is why it's been announced. So it's like, we're getting two series of Torchwood back to back for the next 12 months.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. You know, who's to say if they don't, announce season three before the end of that? So who's to say?
It'd be interesting to see whether they actually include any of the characters from Miracle Day, because at the end of Miracle Day, the CIA agent was made immortal as well. It'd be interesting to see whether or not Big Finish pick up on that and go with it or not.
Yeah. I do know that the third episode of the current series, this first series, will feature Gwen and her husband, Reese, and will be set. The first two episodes are set before Yanto's death, because Yanto is featured in episode two. But Gwen and Reese are going to be featured in episode three, and that one is going to be set after Miracle Day. We'll pick up several years after Miracle Day and find out what's been happening with them, and then also cover that chapter of the ongoing storyline.
Well, you can't really do a Torchwood series without Gwen. She's not the one constant that's been in all of them, as long as Captain Jack. And Reese as well. He kind of became a main character by default. It's kind of funny to see that happen. That's about all we've really got time for in terms of news. Now it's time for our interview, which is with Mark Miller, and it's got a running time of 41 minutes, so we wrapped quite a bit. So I'll just introduce this now, and I'm going to shut up and let you guys listen. Welcome comics writer extraordinaire Mark Miller to the show, who of course is known for having written comics such as Kick-Ass and Wanted, but he's also well known for having penned The Ultimates, which pretty much in so many ways set the template, I think, for the Avengers movies in quite a few ways. Hey Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, thank you.
It's great having you on. I've read quite a bit of your work, and I'm familiar with quite a lot of what you've done. So it's just brilliant to have somebody on that I know, which doesn't mean to say that I'm discouraging people that I don't know from coming on the show. It's just kind of like a little bit easier, as you say. But first off, how did you get into writing comics? Was it always what you wanted to do? Because it's, there's so many avenues for writers to go in.
Yeah, it's funny, being a comic writer when I was a kid was a bit like saying, if you went to the careers officer, which I did, and say, look, I want to write Superman, it was a bit like, those crazy X Factor contestants who are like, I want to be as big as Leona Lewis. It's like I felt like one of those mental patients. And I was even aware of the careers officer looking at me like, you poor fool, this isn't a job. Machines do that or something, But they never imagined that it was actually a job. And I was like, well, there's a guy called Stan Lee and he's done it for years, and then there's guys who replaced him. And I was trying to explain, and they were like, if you'd be interested in maybe doing one of these youth training schemes instead, And I was like, well, no, I really want to write comics, but, it never seemed to materialise. And I used to send off submissions. When I was about 13, I was sending off submissions, and I knew I really wanted to do it. And then just weirdly, ever since I caught up with what I wanted, Alan Moore, when I was 13, broke in and was working at DC. And then the next generation of guys who came along in the late 80s, like Grant Morrison, Pete Milligan, Jamie Delano, they all broke through as well. So suddenly geography wasn't a problem. I thought I could live in Scotland, I could live in Glasgow, and still work for DC Comics in New York. You know, so like it was just inspirational seeing all these other guys doing it, and I think I just plugged away until eventually they got so sick of me they just gave me one, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's funny what you say about careers officer, because when I was leaving school, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I did a lot of sport and a lot of stuff, and I was pretty multi-tongued at different creative sort of things. So careers officer asked me what I wanted to do. So I said, I want to be a male model. And and you know, I just said it because I just couldn't think of what I wanted to do, and I thought, oh, this is a waste of time anyway. And I got this report back a few weeks later telling me all the traits and attributes that I need to be a male model.
That's amazing.
I thought, okay.
Did it work out for you?
No, it never worked out for me. Apparently, with me only being 5'10", I was about 2 inches too short.
That's it. Clothes look terrible on someone who's 2 inches too short.
Yeah. I know.
But you know what, it's funny, when I was in primary school, I remember, that was kind of common question that the class would be asked, you know, like, what's your ambition when you're older? And even then, I was still being comic book writer, and I remember a boy who was sitting beside me, this guy Jared, said a burglar, and he was only about 7, and the teacher said, you can't be a burglar, that's not a job, and he looked really upset, and he said, my dad's a burglar, and the weird thing was his dad was a burglar, so it was a kind of family business, you know, so I grew up in
an interesting place. Yeah, I'm from a government, you know, kind of like an estate here in Manchester. So yeah, not you meet a lot of interesting characters for sure. used to be a drug dealer and lived down the street from us. He's called Tattoo Stan. And, you know, he was covered head to toe in tattoos, even his face. And, you know, everyone was terrified of him. And yet it was the most mellow person you could actually meet.
It's funny because there was a guy in my neighborhood growing up called Balder. And I'd love to say he was the most mellow guy, you know, but I remember he got drunk one night when he was about 15, stole a pickup truck and towed away the local telephone box and things like that, you know. So there's a lot of kind of characters and everything, you know, and I guess it all informs you as an adult, isn't it? You know, as you get older, you kind of, you bring a lot of that stuff to your work, I guess. You know, I mean, it's what makes you different from the guys growing up in Santa Monica and LA and everything, you know, when you're doing your adult job.
Mm-hmm. You've actually wrote some of the big Marvel stuff, such as Civil War, which,
yeah,
you know, as I was explaining earlier, it's kind of like, in a lot of ways, it set the template for what Marvel are doing in films. And,
yeah,
and indeed, your comic book Civil War is sort of like a big big example of that. I'm just wondering, is there a particular confrontation or element from the comic book that you're really hoping to see on the big screen?
You know, it's kind of fun seeing it in general, you know, like, I mean, just Iron Man versus Captain America, the superheroes split in the middle. It's such a very simple Marvel idea. Like, when I was a kid, what made Marvel very different from DC is the DC guys all got along. You know, the DC guys just hung out and they were very adult and grown up. And the Marvel characters were always getting into fights. It was more like teenagers or children, really, you know. You would always have the Hulk fighting the Thing, or, you know, a misunderstanding and the heroes all fighting each other. So Civil War was really just that. It was kind of like my inner fanboy, you know, just thinking, wouldn't it be cool to see Iron Man fighting Captain America or whatever? And yeah, I think just after watching The Avengers a couple of times now, I think you just want to see these guys beat each other up, you know. Like, I'm kind of curious who's going to win those fights. And if I'm a 10-year-old boy going to see it, you know, that's even more
exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so it's kind of like, did Civil War come out before Heroes came out on TV?
You know, I can't remember, 2006, I'm not sure quite, probably around the same time, maybe around the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if Eric Kripke sort of like borrowed what?
Heroes borrowed a lot, actually, you know, there's a lot of stuff, not from me, but there's a lot of stuff you saw from other books. Watchmen, I think the final kind of season one, the final five episodes, there's a lot of Watchmen stuff in there, but you know, these things are there to be stolen, you know, like, you know, the companies generally, Marvel and DC, stole them from the creators, you know, so like, I think it's only fair that new companies should steal them from Marvel and DC, you know, like, ownership's a funny thing when it comes to ideas.
Well, you know, since you've actually left Marvel and what we could call the mainstream comics, you've actually had a pretty good stab at building your own comics universe, which has given us a lot of different but very flawed hero and anti-hero sort of characters. And you know, I kind of like that because I think as human beings we can actually probably connect more with those characters than we can with, you know, with Superman, who's, you know, let's face it, is pretty much a god. And Batman's just this rich guy. was it kind of always your intention to try and sort of like ground your characters more?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's what Marvel in the beginning did very, very well. I mean, Stan Lee told me a few years back when I was talking to him about Kick-Ass that, you know, I was saying a lot of people were saying that, you know, the characters are unlikable and they're too flawed and all that kind of thing. And he said that he got exactly the same letters with Spider-Man and everything in Fantastic Four. You know, the people who'd grown up in the 50s and the very early 60s seeing these very, very pure characters of DC, like Superman and Batman never did anything wrong, you know. So to have, you know, human traits, even two-dimensional characters, was quite a leap. And people couldn't quite get around a superhero being a little greedy or a little selfish or, you know, thinking in his own interest. And they were, you know, they were odd. They couldn't pay the bills and things. They were just like real people. And what I've tried to do with my stuff is do the 21st century version of that, really, you know, what Stan did. So I just try and make them as relatable as possible. I mean, Kick-Ass is in so many ways my alter ego, you know, like lots of things from my own life, right down to hanging around on comic book message boards in my spare time, you know. So, like, you know, I just try and make it like a real person and graft the superhero stuff onto that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've recently read the preview edition of Chrononauts, which I really enjoyed. I read the trade version. And, you know, I've got to say, initially, I didn't like the new character. I thought, this guy's an asshole. But, you know, the great thing about that story is the journey he goes on. You know, he sort of like goes on this journey, you know, by inviting the time travel thing, he's sort of like won the ultimate lottery ticket.
Yeah.
And you know, he finds that, you know, by doing everything he wants, it's, you know, shit stuff is still going to happen.
Yeah.
And I just sort of like loved that. And but what I also loved about it was sort of like the little twist at the end that you did.
Well, I don't want to give away that ending, but you know, the idea is, it's always interesting when you see a guy on a journey. You know, think of Iron Man 1, you know, like Tony Stark is a weapons dealer, you know, he deals in the destruction of human life, you know, at the beginning of that movie, and by the end of it, he's a hero, you know? Mm-hmm. And I like that, you know, I like that journey, you know, we're quite often used to seeing this nerd becoming a hero or whatever, you know, whether it's Peter Parker or Kick-Ass or whatever. And there's something that's quite interesting to see a guy who's kind of maybe selfish or whatever, you know, learning a lesson, and by the end of it, you know, he's someone you like, or maybe you don't particularly at the beginning. But the thing I thought was interesting with him is I thought where the idea came from really was I was thinking, if you're the sort of guy who could crack time travel, you know, like a Reed Richards or something, you know, you probably don't have a lot of time in your life for people, and your relationships are probably a little bit sort of fragmented. Like, you probably don't visit your dad enough, you probably can't make a marriage work and all that kind of thing. And it just gave me a human angle on a big idea. Like, I love sci-fi that humanizes it, you know, like, that's what was great about the old Twilight Zones, that they would find a human angle on a preposterous idea, but maybe accept it because of that, you know? So what I wanted to do was just a guy who didn't spend enough time with people cracking time travel, ironically.
Yeah. Kind of like Captain Kirk or all those crewmen that died, and you know, the weight of that was always on his shoulders, but yet he couldn't ever really show the rest of his crew because he had to remain a leader.
I think like people have a hard time in the mainstream with big ideas sometimes, you know, like time travel, for example, you know, is a typical concept, you know, the idea of walking around in four dimensions or whatever, you know, flipping back and forth between periods. So I think you always need something to anchor it, you know, and I think it's the same with any form of sci-fi. The best stuff is the stuff that hits the mainstream and goes as wide as possible. Like the original Star Trek series for me was much more interesting, much more successful than the subsequent incarnations of those characters. And I think it's because they grounded it really well. They weren't aiming at a niche sci-fi audience who they already had. I love the fact that children and grandmothers were still watching it as well, you know. So that's what I try and do with all my stuff, you know, as much as it's big crazy ideas and everything, to try and make it something that anyone can understand.
Is Cronenarts going to get made into a movie, you know?
Yeah, that's been put together just now. We've got the two main actors. We know who they both are. One signed already, and the other one we're just waiting to get a signature with, which is really exciting, actually, because I think it'll be a great film. Like, the guys who made Fast and the Furious are doing it over at Universal, and I'd already worked with this guy before. I did a movie called Wanted that was based on one of my books with Angelina Jolie back in 2008. And it's the same producer, this guy Chris Morgan, who I really like a lot. I'm going out to LA in a couple of weeks just to go for a drink with him.
Cool. What I want to know is how much of the movie's budget is going to go on the amazing car chase through the different time zones.
I know, it's like, you know, it costs the same amount of money to have two people talking in a comic as it does to have a four-dimensional car chase, you know, through time. And that's what I love about comics. You never have to think about budget. And then some poor bugger in LA has got to sit and count the beans. Somebody's got to think, oh my God, you know, who do we cut so we can afford this car chase and all that, you know? So yeah, I love it. That's why comics is always the main thing for me. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, something I've noticed about your books is you always seem to be able to, you seem to have a knack of being able to choose a perfect artist and style for each story that you do.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the visceral action in Cronenarts and also the stuff that John Romita Jr. did on Kick-Ass and stuff like that. How do you go about choosing the artist? Do you have a particular system or?
I just actually think about, you know, who feels right for it. It's a bit like casting with the movie. Like I remember in Kingsman, we were looking at so many different people. Matthew's down in London, Matthew Bond, the director, and I'm up here in Glasgow, and Matthew would send me a little link every night of that day's audition. And they're all guys between 18 and 25. They're all about the same height, same colouring, you know, the same haircut and everything approximately. But they're not right, you know, and you're looking at it and you think, no, that's not Eggsy, that's not the guy, you know. And, like, then suddenly Taron Egerton came in, and Matthew, I was down in London at the time, I was in the studio, and Matthew says, get downstairs and have a look in the edit suite. There's this guy I want you to have a look at. I think he could be the one. And I watched it, and within 10 seconds, that was him. And it's the same with an artist, you know. Like, I said to John Romita Jr. in 2006, well, I'm doing this thing, Hit Girl. It was originally going to be based around Hit Girl. And I said, I want you to draw it. And if you don't draw it, I'm just not going to do it. And that's why it started 2 years, because he was busy doing other things. And then, by the time I came to write it, I based it around Kick-Ass instead. And I wrote a wee bit of it, you know, I wrote some of the Hit Girl stuff. And then nobody else could have drawn it. Like, if it had been some slick kind of artist drawing it, it wouldn't have looked right. I hinted that gritty Martin Scorsese vibe, you know. Similarly, somebody who didn't put the research in that Sean did, Cronenarts could have been a disaster. Imagine a guy who didn't draw the backgrounds and make everything look so correct, and a guy who didn't have a love of vehicles the way that Sean has. He loves drawing cars and trucks and things. So all of these things, it could have gone horribly wrong with the wrong artist. And sometimes even guys are brilliant at what they do, but just not right for a particular project. I guess it just comes from being a fan. I look at the stuff and I think, you know what, you'd be great for this. Starlight, a book I did a year or two back, is an old kind of Buck Rogers coming out of retirement kind of thing. You know, and I wanted it to have a kind of Mobius vibe. You know, I've been a European looking ever since. Mm-hmm. I went and I got this guy, Torin Parlock, who had a fantastic Mobius style, but had only ever really done crime comics with The Punisher. So sometimes you can spot something in somebody and you just, you know they're right.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you just mentioned Hit Girl there, and yeah. I remember when the comic came out and subsequently the film came out, and the media were going absolutely crazy about this young girl, you know, using all the foul language and stuff like that. And I remember sort of thinking, what world are these people living in?
To be honest, I didn't write any of that swearing. That was Chloe made all that up. Even when she was 10, she had a disgusting mouth.
Oh, but you just sort of like, it kind of made me laugh because the media going, oh, it's gone too far this time. And I'm thinking, yeah, have these people not been around the housing estates or something?
Do you know the funny thing? I thought it would actually create more of a stir. I remember thinking, were you actually going to go to prison or something? You know, and I was actually quite surprised. There was really just a couple of things, like the Daily Mail and, you know, a couple of kind of people you'd expect, really, you know. I thought everybody would behave. I was actually quite shocked. I was a little bit disappointed, you know. But everybody was very sensible about it all. They were all like, yeah, it's just good fun. Don't take it too seriously. And all that. Oh, right, okay. I thought it was going to be like the Passion of the Christ where I'd be getting executed, you know, beheaded somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, today you've created 9 original comic book characters of your own, comic book universes of your own. Can you see there ever being a time where maybe you cross a couple of them over or a crossover?
Oh yeah, definitely that is the plan. My plan is to create 25 of these franchises. I think I'm actually on number 11 or something now. I think I'm on 11 or 12 or something. You know, there's a whole bunch of them. Every one of them is either a film or a television show or being made as a film or a television show. And we're just trying to be Marvel. I mean, my plan is to be Marvel, but all the characters are owned by the guys who created them. You know, so Dave Gibbons and I have got Kingsman Secret Service, Johnny Romita and I have got Kick-Ass, Frank Quitely and I have got Jupiter's Legacy and everything. We own it, so we own it in the same way that J.K. Rowling owns Harry Potter. Like, nobody has 1% of it outside of us. And it's great because, my God, you know, you go back 7 decades and nobody owns these characters except the big corporations who sell them on to other big corporations. Like, the original guys are lucky to get tickets to go and see the movies, really, you know. So this was always the plan, to build an ethical company where we all own their own stuff.
Yeah, I mean Superman, you know, Superman's a case in point, isn't it, really? You know, for that.
All of them. I mean, Superman actually is slightly better, but the guys who created it got a tiny pension, but at least they got something. I mean, it's still disgraceful, but like, but Green Lantern, I mean, the guys who created Green Lantern didn't even get a credit on the movie. And maybe that's no bad thing. I mean, if I'd made up Green Lantern, I think I'd have been hiding when that film came out as well, but like, but, you know, it's quite sad, you know, like, they didn't get a credit on the film, they didn't get any money, and they certainly didn't get a pension when they were alive, and their families are still around, you know. I think some of them have got widows, and I don't even think they were invited to go and see the movie, you know. So Creator's Rights is it's a very sad story, actually, when you hear of these amazing characters that have all been made up. You know, Marvel and DC have both got about 5,000 characters each, approximately. And they're all owned by corporations, really, which is a shame, you know. So I'm really lucky to be in this generation of guys who, you know, own their own work. It's great, because it means when there's a video game or a lunchbox or whatever, it's us, it goes to, you know, and my kids can be spoiled brats in the future, you know. They can be the vacuous Paris Hiltons of the year 2040.
A book that you released earlier in the year, and this kind of caught me interest, and I've only really just caught up with some of the stuff. I mean, I've only just ordered Kingsman on trade, yeah, for God's sake. I've seen the movie first.
Yeah.
And I've just ordered the trade because I'm curious to see the differences between that and the movie. Like you are. Well, the one that caught me interested is one you've done this year, MPH, which it's not only got a fantastic setting, but it's got a really fun concept. And I'm just wondering, how did you come up with the idea for that? And
well, my best pal from school, actually, was doing a consultancy thing. And I don't know what it's like to be your best pal. I have no idea what my best pals do for a living, right? Like, you know, when you get together with your pals, you never really talk about work. So I have no idea what they do, but one of them is a sort of computer guy, something to do with computers, and he was working out in Detroit. And he said, "Do you want to come out?" And I was like, "Yeah, right." And I headed out and I went to see him. And it's funny because growing up in the west of Scotland, we've got this real love affair with America. You know, like, I don't know if it's the same down your way, but growing up, I always thought of America as being like everybody's a millionaire. You know, like everybody's got giant cars and tons of money and everything. And it was kind of a real shock to go out and see something that really looked devastating. Like in some parts of town, it looked like a movie set or something. You know, where you've seen the pictures in the papers if you've never been out there, you know, like traps thrown out of buildings and all that kind of thing. And crazy statistics like half the streetlights not working. Like the city couldn't afford to keep the streetlights on all the time. So half of them are switched off, which makes it a mugger's paradise. And police stations and hospitals being closed down, you know, no-go zones, you know. So it did feel like Robocop, you know. I mean, we were up in a nice part of town, but we went for a drive about. I went for a barbecue down in a part of town that wasn't so nice. And, like, I just thought, you know what, that's a great setting for a superhero study, because superheroes are always about how awesome it is to live in the West. You know, it's always like a billionaire Bruce Wayne or billionaire Tony Stark, and everybody's very professional and everything's all very fantastic for them and all that, you know. And I thought, it's not really that representative of the whole of America. You know, there's vast chunks of the States. Now they've travelled around a lot of the States, not just the coast. I see that there's gigantic poverty in the States. And I thought, it is kind of interesting that, you know, we go and see movies like Iron Man or Batman, Dark Knight Rises and all that, and we're really worried about these billionaires. And half of the audience is watching it thinking, I can't even pay my rent, you know. So, and it is weird, you know, that there isn't real people. There's no superhero stories about real people. So I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do something that's not about Gotham City, and it's actually about the real world, you know. And Superman was created out of the poverty of the 1930s. So to maybe create four characters out of the poverty of present-day Detroit, you know, that was all my thinking behind it, like, not really.
And also, Superman's origin story is, you know, he's brought up on a farm.
Yeah.
You know, so, I guess back then, and even to a certain extent now, you can't get any more humbugger beginnings than that. But I think you're right. I mean, one thing I'd love to see more of is kind of more working class superheroes that, you know, that pretty much have nothing but the basics.
Yeah, if you think about it, that's how most people live their life. You know, the average person is by nature average, you know, and superheroes tend not to be that. But I try and do that, you know, like Kick-Ass works in a comic book store. You know, he's a schoolboy who works in a comic book store who eventually becomes a policeman. You know, he's a blue-collar guy, you know, And most of my characters, I mean, I haven't actually really thought about this until they've said it out loud, but, you know, the richest guy is Nemesis, who's a billionaire, but he's the bad guy and everything, you know, and I try and kind of ground everyone and make everyone a bit relatable, because you don't want everybody to be, you know, as cool in their private lives as they are in their superhero identities. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're the guy that Fox goes to in order to consult on their superhero movies.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, what sort of things do they usually come to you with that kind of require a comic
book
design?
It's fun. It's just like, normally my job is me sitting at the computer on Twitter when I should be writing. You know, that's my day, sitting in my pants or something like that. And like, but the Fox thing, I started doing in August 2012, and I signed on for 4 years, so I'll be doing it for about another year, probably about another 11 months. And the idea is that I'm just sort of available, you know, so they get me out occasionally, and I'll sit in a room with the execs, you know, the people around the studio, and just talk about like what would be a good character to use from the X-Men universe or something in his own movie. Like, the very first day I went in August 2012, the first thing I said was, you should do a Deadpool movie. Deadpool's a great character. It's a brilliant visual. Kids love it. It's one of really two or three Marvel characters that have been created in the last 30 years that have actually stuck, you know, that people like. And, like, you know, the whole Deadpool section in my local bookstore. And, like, you know, so things like that, you know, I'll just sit and then sort of say, you know, who'd be good to be in it. And we just bounce ideas around and everything. And I kind of love that because it's kind of like being a proper adult. I feel like Don Draper or something like that. I'm sitting there dressed smartly, sitting at a desk, sitting chatting with people. And then I come back home and I'm just making tea in my pants and all that again, yeah.
Yes. It sounds like a fun job. I love to talk about comics and stuff all day.
Yeah, and somebody pays you to come in and talk. Great, you know? And you get to criticize other people and all that stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, like my case is with certain actors, I say, oh, he's got about as much charisma as Treebark.
It's great fun because you know the stuff you sit in the pub and chat about with your pals. You know, you'll sit and have a drink and you'll be, oh, you know who'd be a great so-and-so, you know. It's actually just doing that, but somebody's saying it. It's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking, you know, Deadpool, with him being sort of like not kind of having the moral compass that Spider-Man has.
Yeah.
You know, Spider-Man won't kill, Deadpool won't have any hesitation and stuff like that, and with him being sort of like that bit more edgier,
yeah.
Do you think if that movie is sort of like successful with an R rating, but it could maybe possibly make a case for Nemesis? Because I'd love to see a Nemesis film.
Oh, we're making a Nemesis film right now.
Yeah.
We're doing
it over at
Warner Brothers.
I'd love to see that because I often find the bad guys more interesting.
Do you know what? I think you're right. It's funny because if you think about it, in 75 years, 78 years of superheroes, it's so weird that we haven't really had any bad guy movies because in cinema, we have bad guy stuff all the time. We have, like, you know, Goodfellas or The Godfather and all that. You know, any of these films all around the world. There's great crime movies, but you never really get it about superheroes. They always just do the good guy. So that's why Nemesis, I think, was quite interesting. Like Tony Scott, who was the original director on it, Tony said to me that the reason he bought it, the reason he wanted it, was for that reason. He said it felt more like a European superhero thing, you know, when it was about the guy on the other side of the gun, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also, you know, I'd love to see a Lex Luthor movie. You know, Paul Cornell, a few years back, he was writing for Action Comics, and he did this interesting storyline, Next Luthor, which explored, you know, him, and, you know, and he wasn't necessarily that he was a bad guy, he kind of saw himself as a hero.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think the Joker is another one as well. I'll tell you a really interesting thing. So 1966, you know, like since the Batman movie in 1966, there has never been a Batman movie that's made a profit until Dark Knight Rises that didn't have a Joker in it.
Wow.
And it's crazy. And people forget, like, even Batman Begins, which is actually my favourite of those three movies, Batman Begins made $392 million, I think, but on a budget of $200 million. And with marketing, it would have had to crack probably close to about $500 million to break even, and it made $392. So even Batman Begins made a small loss. But when you put the Joker in those movies, it goes crazy. It goes absolutely crazy. Batman Returns didn't do well. You had Batman and Robin was a catastrophe, you know. I think Batman Forever did okay. But the real money, it goes crazy whenever you put the Joker in it. The Jack Nicholson movie did insane business. I think in modern terms, that movie did something nuts, like $2 billion or something, if you adjust it for inflation, you know, it's crazy. And see the Romero back in the 60s. So weirdly, I think people prefer the Joker to Batman. I think the Joker is actually what the general public are interested in. And that's what's going to be very interesting with Suicide Squad, because I heard they were doing a Suicide Squad movie, and I thought, all right, that sounds all right, you know. And then I heard the Joker was going to be part of the team, and I thought, oh my God, that sounds amazing. Sounds really exciting.
I mean, I don't envy, is it Jared Leto who's playing the Joker?
Yeah.
I don't envy the task he's got, because, you know, you kind of had Heath Ledger and or the Hoopner with that, and before that Jack Nicholson. So it's kind of like it's not the sort of role that you'd easily take on as an actor with that much of a legacy behind it.
So he's doing his own thing though, which is interesting, because when I heard him, I thought, because he is quite annoying, isn't he? He's one of those actors that's quite annoying. And then I saw that first picture and I thought, oh my God, I'm in. This looks really interesting, you know, because it didn't look like a Joker I'd seen before. And that's what I felt when I saw Heath Ledger's film. No, no, but you, when I heard Heath Ledger was cast as a Joker, I was like, oh God, that sounds terrible, you know. And then when I saw that first picture, it looked fantastic. It looked great. So every generation just seems to have a new incarnation of the Joker, you know, like, as Batman becomes less interesting and more Stephanie Dharma and all that kind of thing, you know, the Joker seems to become more interesting.
Yeah, I kind of have this theory about Batman.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you know, based because of his fetish for rubber and stuff like that. I think he's a repressed homosexual, you know.
I don't think he's that repressed. I think he's probably pretty active.
You know, I said that to a friend of mine who's a real diehard Batman fan, and you know, he wouldn't talk to me for weeks afterwards.
I think Batman would be quite happy with being gay. You know, I'd be happy reading a gay Batman comic. You know, it'd be good to see him getting off with somebody, because he never seems to get off with anybody. I always think Batman looks sad. If he's a nice guy at home, I think that would cheer him right up.
And his relationship with women have all kind of ended in disaster.
Yeah, they always seem to die and fall off cliffs, get murdered and all that. It's like, I don't know. Maybe I don't think he's cut out for the ladies. I think Batman definitely would be happy with the gents.
Yeah. And I'm agreeing with that. I think it's time to move on to another. What advice would you give anyone that is currently looking to try and write for comics? And what pitfalls would you warn them about?
Number one, do it. It's brilliant. It is honestly the most fun job in the world. It really is fantastic. Like I say, when I was 5, 6, 7, that's what I wanted to do for a living, right? And most people say, I want to be a dinosaur hunter, or I want to be a famous international footballer, or I want to be an astronaut. And being a comic writer kind of wasn't as far-fetched, especially when you live in Scotland, you know, in the 70s and 80s. And for getting to do it is just brilliant. You know, I mean, there isn't a day I don't switch on my computer and think, you know what, this is a pretty fun job. This is great. I'm making up stories, and people are buying them. This is cool. And, like, you know, so the number one thing is, if you have a passion for it, do it. And if you're any good, you will absolutely find out. And my big advice is, what I say to everyone, is to put it up online. Like, whatever line of work you go into, you don't get paid at first. And whatever you do, you have to train. Mm-hmm. And you have to prove your worth. So, like, nobody pays you, you know, to come and audition as an actor. Nobody pays you to come in and audition as a singer. And similarly, nobody's going to pay you to try out being a writer. You know, you've got to do something to put yourself out there. So what I would say to people is, pick something short. Don't waste too much of your time. Make it as good as you can. Maybe 12 pages long, 20 pages long. Find an artist who's willing to work for free as well and be showcased in the same way you do. Do, like I said, a very short story. Make it as great as you can. Put it up online. My website, mellowworld.tv, actually has a forum for this, and a lot of people have got good work out of it at Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, everywhere. Even at Mellow World, I've got a guy who I found on my website now. And you'll be found. Because there's so, think about it, there's so many garbage TV shows and movies and comics and everything that if you're even halfway decent, you're going to stand out, you know? So, like, so I think if you get any talent and if you're excited by it, give that a try, you know, and just see what happens. And, like, it's amazing how fast people can get work and how fast their lives can change. I see it all the time. I see guys who've wanted to do it for years and then they just take that step and they try it and never look back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's funny what you're saying because I've actually been learning music for the past 3 years. I've always wanted to play guitar since a very young age, but I never had the opportunity to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been getting lessons and I go to this place every couple of days and play with other musicians. And I was just sort of like doing something in the studio the other day. And some guys are listening from outside the room. One of them comes in as we're wrapping up and goes, well, that was really good. Was that you? And, you know, I'm kind of like, you know, I don't think I'm any good. But, you know, at the same time, that kind of helps me get better, I think, the fact that I think I'm no good.
Oh, definitely. Well, I think you can always think you can improve, but you must have some self-worth in it as well. I think it's so important to actually recognise that what you're doing has value, though, you know, like, because I think you'll never send it to anyone then. You know, that's what will always stop you from sending a demo tape or a sample thing out there, you know, because if you think it's no good, you might be shy with it, you know. Yeah. So I would always say take that step and try it out. But I think the minute you think you're brilliant, that's when you're in trouble. You know, like, there isn't a single story I do that I'm ever entirely happy with, even the ones that have worked out really well and have sold tons or made movies out of or whatever, you know, I always look at it and think, you know what I should have done? I could have shaved 2 panels here. I could have started that scene over here and all that, you know. You can't help it, you know. And I think that's a healthy thing, though, because the minute you think you're brilliant, that's when you lose it, you know. You need criticism. And I always listen. I mean, I've got a new series that's coming out March or April next year that I'm going to announce at the beginning of November. With a big artist, a guy I've wanted to work with for a long time. And I sent the plot around to some pals this morning, and then we all talked about it. You know, I was like, does this make sense and all that? You know, I just like to make sure that it's watertight. Is there any plot holes you can see in things, you know? And I always do that. I like to hear other people's opinions. I see Matthew Vaughn doing that as well, and I think, like, he's as interested in what an intern, like a runner or whatever, is doing around the office. Like, he's as interested in their opinion on a scene as he is from the editor or the, you know, the cinematographer or whatever, because everybody's a potential audience member, you know. So if somebody's like, that doesn't work, you've got to listen, you know. And the minute you shut yourself off, that's whenever you stop doing work that people respect on.
And I think also the thing is, if you're as the creator of this thing, you're quite close to it, so it's usually good to have the outside opinions to give you, you know.
And the internet keeps you going as well. It's funny. I mean, on the one hand, you know, you have people saying, oh, you're a genius and all that, you know. And then on the other hand, you have people saying, he is literally the worst writer, I think, who has ever been invented and all that, you know. And the one time stream, you know, you will see that, you know, on the one news feed. And you can't take either seriously, you know. I mean, it's lovely to be praised and everything, you know. But if you believe the praise, you believe the criticism. You just have to trust in your own stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. In your comics, you make loads and loads of references to pop culture and such. Is one of the other comic book characters. Now, as a kid growing up, what stories, films, and comics from pop culture would you say had the most influence on you in terms of sort of like spurring you into the creative writer that you become?
Well, I think at a pop culture puberty, I guess, between the age of 5 and about 12, 13 maybe, and I think that defined what I was going to be into my entire life. Like, I saw Jaws when I was 5, my brother's girlfriend took me to it, and it was just me and her. It was weird, actually. I don't know why she took me. And like, and I remember she had a hanky. It was very British. She had a hanky over my face, just kind of like a personalised handkerchief. She had that over my face for most of the movie, like it was one of Michael Jackson's kids or something like that, and she just sort of covered up my face anytime it looked scary, but I could look through the lace and actually see the movie. So I remembered every bit of it, and it became my favourite movie, you know. Then I saw Star Wars about a year and a half later, 2 years later. Then there was Close Encounters, Superman, up through Indiana Jones, Superman 2. And I think by 12, that was it. You know, by the time Indiana Jones had hit, that was it. It was cast an eye on this and who I was going to be for the rest of my life. This is what I'm into, you know. And then the other things came along, like Ghostbusters and Gremlins and stuff I loved and all that, but they weren't definitive for me. They weren't like the things that formed me, the way Star Wars and Superman and stuff like that is.
Yeah, I'm a big Indiana Jones fan myself.
It's funny, I've always wondered how it plays in Germany. Well, I'd love to see the box office in Germany. You know? It's like, I wonder if they're like, Indy's a little tough on those guys, you know, it's like, I wonder if it doesn't go down so well over there.
Or even Russia for the last one.
Yeah, to be honest, I think that movie didn't go down anywhere. I think everybody was like, who cares?
Yeah, they kind of lost so much of the character's roots. They should have kept it. You should have kept him fighting supernatural things as opposed to aliens.
Yeah, I know. I think it's just gone too far away timelines as well. Like, it's funny, when I was a kid, I was born in 1969. So, and my dad was in his 40s when I was born, so my dad experienced World War II, right? Mm-hmm. So World War II and Indiana Jones and the Nazis, it didn't feel that far away, it was just like a generation back. But now World War II is like the Civil War, you know, kids, or it's like the Jurassic era or something, you know? I think it's too far away to relate to. So I think Indy, I love him, I absolutely love it, but it just belongs to time, probably.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, do you have any other books that are due out that you'd like to give a plug, or...?
I think September, Chrononauts, a must-buy. Did we talk about Jupiter's Circle? That's out in October?
I don't think we did, no.
Oh, right, I'll very quickly talk about this. Jupiter's Circle is the prequel to the biggest book I've ever launched. I did a book called Jupiter's Legacy that came out a couple of years back. That's Volume 1 is just finished, and Volume 2 is being prepared at the moment with an amazing artist called Frank Whiteley. He's pretty much the best in the industry. He and I did this book. It was a labour of love. It was a big grown-up superhero opera, you know. It was like a thing that covered three generations of superheroes and everything, you know, and like everything I ever wanted to do with a superhero book is in this. It's political, it's romantic, it's a big Shakespearean family drama and everything about what it's like to be the children of the world's greatest superheroes. Like, imagine you were Superman and Wonder Woman kids, like, and you grew up kind of like Carrie Fisher or whatever, you know. You grew up as a Hollywood kid, essentially, that everybody knows, and you're always being compared to your incredible parents, you know? So that was kind of interesting book I did a couple of years back. The prequel to it, which is the story of the parents, I've done as a kind of superhero period drama set in 1959. It's kind of like Mad Men meets the Justice League. So it's a period drama with these kind of cool, lovely superheroes who look awesome, but in their private lives, they're just ordinary people, you know? So, like, one secretly gay, which in 1959 is really interesting because it was at a time when the world was a bit less progressive, and, you know, he'd have been ruined if he'd been outed as being gay. You've got J. Edgar Hoover blackmailing him, you know. You've got a superhero having an affair with a girl who's 19 and cheating on his wife, and everything. She's a young girl who's wanting to be a superhero. He's pretending he's going to make it happen for her and things, you know. So you've got all these kind of, you've got alcoholism, you've got loneliness and all that. It's just a big grown-up Paul Thomas Anderson kind of drama with superheroes in 1959. So Chrononauts is your buy for September, October, Jupiter's Circle. There's the two big books that I've got over the next couple of months.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, thanks for joining us on the show. It's been great having you, and, you know, really nice talking to you.
Oh, you too. Anything, give us a chat.
And that was the wonderful Matt Miller. Really enjoyed talking to that guy. He's done some great comics. He's had some great films made, which have been based on his comics. And, you know, that is definitely someone I'd love to get back on the show at some point. I'd like to thank you all for listening, as always. And I'd also like to take some time to plug some of the other shows that we have here on the League of Geeks Network. We have Genretainment, which is hosted by my good friend Mark Pyle and his wife Julie. And we also have Super Geeked Up, which is kind of like it's kind of like our parent show. You know, it's run by Jeff Burns, and Jeff is the guy that came up with the League of Geeks between us all, and he has a wonderful show which it comes on every Thursday, I think, on Blog Talk, and it's every Wednesday on YouTube. And you know, he basically does a live show, and it's lots of different games. He has guests on, and they play all these cool, fun, geeky games with people, and it's really well worth listening or watching because it's a lot of fun. It's really obvious that Jeff and the gang have a lot of fun making it, and it's, you know, it's just a hoot to do, because I was fortunate enough to actually be a guest on his show a few weeks ago. And, you know, it'd be fun to have Jeff on here, actually, I think. So I might actually do that at some point and invite Jeff to be a guest on SFP Now. But that's about all we've got time for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. You can check out the other shows right here on Blog Talk Radio. Genretainment, Super Geeked Up, they both have their own channels. Genretainment is blogtalkradio.com/genretainment.com. And Super Geeked Up is blogtalkradio.com/supergeekedup. And, of course, we'll be back at you next week on Tuesday with our new show, and then again on Friday with another exciting interview for you guys to listen to. So, again, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. Feel free to leave your comments and feedback on our channel. Be great to hear from you. That's about all we have time for this week. So, bye.